from Technical University. So it's a pleasure to be here. I was here last week already for this SPIN conference, and I gave a talk which is a little related to this, but I will bring this now in a little broader, let's say, point of view, and will give you a brief overview of what we are doing at the Walter Schottky Institute. And this is basically subgroups which belong to my area in the Walter Schottky Institute. I will select a few things what is related to spins. But first I want to introduce this group. One key thing is that we are quite good, I think, in semiconductor nanostructures, and we have an ME machine which produces very high mobility and also nanostructures. And Anna is relatively new. She came in October, in the moment taking over these nanostructure projects in my group. Then there is a quantum transport group headed by Matt Grayson. He looks normally a little different because there was Einstein here, and we had a lot of high school students, and we made some show for the high school students. He sort of dressed a little like young Einstein, and that's why his hair is a little different, and also normally he doesn't smoke a pipe or so. So he is doing mainly quantum transport in nanostructures, edge channels, but also novel structures like a chain of coupled dots. And then I have one small group which we started again in my area. We were working in silicon-based systems already 20 years ago. Silicon germanium based systems, and then this decayed a little, so we were not very active, but we are starting new now, especially with isotope engineering and things like this. We have an MBE machine, a molecular beam epitaxy machine, and Dominique Bouchard is a young postdoc who is starting in this area and works in this area. Then we have one group which is in bio nanostructures, that's Mark Torno, and then Jonathan Finley. They got last year, they had a baby, and that's why I put this picture, because he was not in the group picture, which I may show at the end. And he is doing mainly the optical spectroscopy of quantum dots and controlling charge and spin in quantum dots and coupling of quantum dots. So this is are the groups. And what are the spin-related topics? Now, the spin-related topics are mainly in this area, so based on certain structures, a little in this area and in this area, where spin plays a role really in the research what we are doing. The main part of the spin-related work in the Schottky Institute is based on indium gallium arsenide self-assembled dots, which is shown schematically here. Then also in arrays of dots, either fabricated by cleaved edge overgrowth or double cleaved edge overgrowth, mainly in transport where we have source drain, and then a chain of dots where we with a gate can put in maybe one spin, one electron in the system. It's quite complicated technology, but it gives access to a highly controlled chain of quantum dots. Here we grow in the first growth direction, for example, a multi-quantum well layer with the source and drain contact, just n-type. Then we cleave it and grow in the second growth layer here, barrier, maybe a quantum well on this side, and then we cleave it again. This is the 110 phase, and then we grow a barrier here with a gate electrode on this side. Then we can deplete a two-dimensional channel, and the last channel which is left over goes along this corner. And if this, and we can modulate this corner in a way that we have here an array of quantum dots where we can, with a gate voltage, can put in something like one electron. This is a project which is relatively new. We have managed and demonstrated that we can get a quantum wire along this, and in the moment we are just working on chain of quantum dots and look for something like what's called maybe a MOT transistor, that you put one electron in each dot and then look for what the spin structure is if you have coupling between the dots. But this is future work. We are just, it's not so easy. We demonstrated a quantum wire here. But then we are working also in getting very good arrays of quantum dots. This is also on cleavage planes. These are self-assembled dots. Then there's quite a nice work by Matthew Grayson on P-channels on 110 gallium arsenide, where in a high magnetic field he gets a crossing, especially in the lowest lambda level, between the two spin states of the P-channel. It's a very well-defined crossing where you switch from one spin polarization to the other spin polarization in a fixed magnetic field. And he has just published one paper on this. I will not have time to talk about this. And then in the newer group where we come back to the silicon germanium, we have mainly two aspects. One is we try to get something like magnetic ions into the silicon germanium system and look for magnetic properties, which is a little, as we also, to get really diluted magnetic semiconductors is not so easy here. It's relatively moderate temperatures, gross temperatures, one gets already manganese germanium precipitates, is manganese 7, germanium 5 precipitates, which are ferromagnetic up to room temperature, and it's very difficult to get diluted manganese into the system. But we have quite nice results now for growing at very low temperature, something like 60 centigrade, very coherent manganese incorporation into germanium. So this is one of the projects. And the last thing is that we have in our silicon-based MBE machine introduced isotope clean material, both silicon 29 and 28, so where you have spin 1/2 or no nuclear spin, and also germanium 73 and 70, where you have germanium 70 no nuclear spin, and germanium 73 you have a nuclear spin of 9/2. And we are working on heterostructures on silicon-silicon germanium to have electron channels in a material with no nuclear spin in the system, or then can control also the nuclear spin in these materials and try to manage or to in a way engineer the interaction, hyperfine interaction between electrons. Nuclear spins in such system. So these are roughly the projects which are running in my group, which have to do something, I would say, with spin, which is this workshop here, spin-related phenomena. Now I will first talk a little about spin storage and spin lifetimes in self-assembled dots. In my talk last week, those who have heard this at the end very briefly discussed this. What we do is when we have a self-assembled quantum dots, so indium gallium arsenide, we can confine electrons and holes, and if we embed them in certain diodes, diode structures, we can excite with the polarization, let's say, a certain spin state in the system. That's due to the optical selection rules which we have. And in an electric field, we can get rid of the hole and then wait some time and store the spin in the quantum dot, and after some time bring the hole back, or holes back, several holes, and look for the recombination if it's still polarized like this. So these are these kind of dots which are either indium arsenide or indium gallium arsenide, which are embedded, let's say, in gallium arsenide here, and these dots are the basis of most of this work which I'm talking about. And
why is this important in this self-assembly? Or is this not important?
It's not important. The only thing is what we have with this self-assembled dot is a relatively deep confinement potential. We get the confinement potential of something like 300 millielectron volts for the electrons and holes, compared to many other dots where this confinement potential is very shallow. And so this deep minimum, also when you store carriers in here, if you have much shallower dots, you lose the carriers by thermal activation, except if you go to very low temperatures.
It's important that it is deep, or also the confinement frequency is high.
What we are doing is mainly optical spectroscopy, and what I will show is what we also want, that the energy separation to the excited states is relatively large, which
that's an important physics.
Right, which increases what we see the lifetime, as a spin lifetime, so T1 time in such dots. Because this depends on the separation to the excited states in such a potential well. And this is typically in these dots is of the order of 30 to 50 millielectron volts, the separation to the higher states in such a system. Now the polarization selection rules are very clean, because the top is, let's say, pure heavy hole, And at least if we have the polarization, let's say, if we come in with light in Z direction, which is, let's say, perpendicular to the growth direction, we have this relatively clean selection rules. When we come in with sigma plus, we define one spin and sigma minus the other, and this goes also when with a recombination. So a very nice optical tool to look at these things. Now, how do we do this experimentally? We are not yet able to do really, let's say, this spin lifetime measurements on a single dot, but we do it on single spins in many dots. And the many dots means something like 1,000 dots. We have ideas how we can do this really dot, but this is not yet really done in the experiment. So the experiment looks like this. We have a P, in this case for electron storage, we have a P back contact, have a Schottky barrier, this is intrinsic, and have just a semi-transparent gate electrode on top. Then we apply a voltage, and this is structured like this, that we have here a larger barrier for the electrons, which is the aluminium gallium arsenide here. So when we excite resonantly an electron hole pair and have reverse bias, the hole can tunnel out here and the electron is stored in the system. You can do the same thing with hole storage when you just make here an N-type contact, and then you just reverse the whole structure. Then when we have stored the electrons, then we wait some time, and then we put the forward bias, and we re-inject holes into this layer, and we just look at the recombination, and look at the properties of this light which is coming out here. So this is a kind of electroluminescence, so it's one of the simplest devices which we can make. It's a Schottky diode, which I sort of in reverse bias, I do something like, in principle, photocurrent, but because of this barrier, the photocurrent is only transient, only the hole goes out and the electron stays there. And then after some time, I do electroluminescence. I have stored charge and bring the holes back in and can just look at the readout. And this is typically what you get for these kind of dots. This is because we look at many, we get an inhomogeneous broadening, and this is at low temperature, and if we wait 12 microseconds, it's bringing back, so we store the electron for 12 microseconds, and we excite here with the laser, and then we get close to the laser line this resonant peak, but when we excite at the high energy side, we get also this lower peak, which is probably due to, because of this inhomogeneous broadening, we may excite some of the larger dots in the excited state, but then there are also phonon-assisted processes. We may excite this laser line dots which have a smaller energy separation, but phonon-assisted we absorb in this, and this gives this broad emission down here. If we, for example, then, as this would be just because they relax down and have then emission further in the red. If we do this in the lower energy tail here, we get just this resonant peak because these other processes do not exist because I look at the dots with the smallest energy here. So you can shift this if you really through. It's really a resonant excitation of this charge storage, and we measured this charge storage for a very long time. At low temperature, this goes forever. I mean, after hours, you still store the charge in such a system. Now, this is the basis for doing spin storage, and just to repeat it again, now we just use circular polarized light, and after some time, we look at the polarization of the emission of the light of such systems, and this is one of the experiments. I will explain in a minute why we apply a magnetic field here. This is at 8 Tesla and at low temperature, and this is a storage time of 2 microseconds. So in the magnetic field, we have the Zeeman splitting here, and if I excite with sigma plus, I pump into the upper Zeeman level here. And then we detect here, for example, sigma plus emission and sigma minus emission, and at least in the resonance peak you see a relatively strong polarization, which is, by the way, getting smaller and smaller. So more I do energy relaxation in the process before I measure it. So the resonant peak has the strongest polarization. The more energy relaxation the carrier does, the less this polarization is remained in such a system. The control experiment experiment is that we pump in with sigma minus in the lower Zeeman level, and then the sigma minus polarization is high after these 2 microseconds. And if you use unpolarized excitations, then you have the same intensity basically for both polarizations. So this works very nicely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't why there's this structure? So it first goes down, it comes up again, and it goes down again.
This here, because there are 2 processes involved here. One is, as I said in the beginning, these are not resonant excited dots, and the relaxation is either from the, let's say, excited state to the ground state, which is a finite energy of typically 20, 30 millielectron volts, or it's phonon assisted, and then it's mainly phonon assisted, which is also of the order 35 in this range, and that's why you have mainly, let's say, it shifted. You have a minimum here, but this the energy relaxation is typically something like 30, 40 millielectron volts, which you have here, which is dominant. Okay, there is one open question which we discussed a lot, and we have no solution. We don't know if it's an intrinsic or an extrinsic effect. If you look at this polarization versus magnetic field, this polarization has this behavior, and you don't get 100% polarization. We get experimentally higher polarization when we pump in the low energy tail, when we don't have these relaxation processes, or not in this high energy part. Maybe we get also at this high energy part some excitation from the light hole states, I don't know really. But we get typically 60% polarization at high magnetic fields. In some samples, and depending how we excite, maybe also 80, but never 100%. Also at the short times. It's never 100%. Also the spin relaxation time is very long. Now why we need a magnetic field, the reason is because these quantum dots, here is typical the energy spectrum again of such quantum dots. You see here, this is the energy gap, roughly 1.2 electron volts, and this is the splitting from the ground to the excited state here. And what you have is, when you do optics, you can have, let's say, dark excitons, which have, the 2 spin states with a difference of plus minus 2, or bright excitons, and this gives a splitting of roughly 100 microelectron volts. And then these are the one which you are looking at, these bright excitons. In the case, but typically these quantum dots have also an anisotropic exchange splitting due to shape anisotropy, due to anisotropy in strain, and maybe a small effect also due to the crystal structure of the system. And this is of the order of 10 to 50 microelectron volts. And this is what makes the polarization selection rules that it's not sigma minus and sigma plus. So what we have to add is a magnetic field, which gives me a larger Zeeman splitting than this anisotropic exchange splitting to get the clean selection rules.
But when how large is Zeeman splitting?
The Zeeman splitting depends on magnetic field, and we can... At 8 Tesla, it's more like 10 times this energy, roughly. So it depends a little on the situation. It can be also zero, yeah, right. That depends on the G factor and things like this. But in this situation, you can engineer the G factor. But here we have typically 10 times this value as the Zeeman energy. So when we are out here, we would expect very clean polarization selection rules. And we don't get the 100%, so this is one of the...
Yeah. Have you considered the possibility of having, even though you're exciting resonantly your quantum dot, having extended state also excited?
Maybe we have some contributions like this. The tendency is if we excite at lower energy, in the low energy range of the inhomogeneous broadened line, that we get a higher degree of polarization. So this is could go along these lines, that we have other excitations, maybe also from the light hole. Some excitations. Just to show you that one can measure, and several groups have measured this anisotropic exchange splitting. This is a nice measurement recently in photocurrent, where you see this anisotropic exchange splitting of a single dot. With here the splitting is 11 microelectron volts. It depends from dot to dot, and the line width is 3 microelectron volts here, which is I think a very nice spectrum of this anisotropic exchange splitting without magnetic field. Okay, so we have seen we can do spin storage, not to 100%, 60 to 80% probability the spin is preserved. Now we want to look at the spin dynamics and the dependence on magnetic field, temperature, and maybe discuss a little the spin flip mechanism. Now the spin dynamics is like this. What I do is I just wait longer before I re-inject the holes and look at the polarization of the light. So this is excited with sigma minus, so we pump in the lower Zeeman level. And then we wait here 1 millisecond, these are these measurement points, and we see that the polarization is just not changed. We still have a strong polarization of the sigma minus and a weak one of the sigma plus over at least a millisecond here, but this is just not changing. So the spin in the ground state at this 1 Kelvin and 8 Tesla remains as it is. If we excite in the upper state, we get a mono-exponential decay of this a sigma plus polarization, and the sigma minus is increasing in intensity. And this is a direct measure of the T1 time. It's a spin relaxation time from the upper Zeeman level to the lower Zeeman level. And if you look at the magnetic field dependence, you see that it's a very strong magnetic field dependence. This is just now excited with sigma plus, so the upper Zeeman level, and detected the decay of the sigma plus polarization versus time, dependent on magnetic field. And what you see is at 12 Tesla, it's relatively fast decaying, and at 5 Tesla, it's nearly not decaying at all over this time scale. So it's a very strong dependence, and this indicates that it's a very clean situation, and that basically only one relaxation mechanism is responsible. We have lifetimes of at least something like 20 milliseconds at 4 Tesla, and so this strong magnetic field dependence, and that indicates that, let's say, the relaxation mechanism is relaxation due to spin orbit mixing of the Zeeman states via phonons, so that the energy relaxation is via acoustic phonons, and there are several theories which I took here this from Kaitsky and Nazarov here, where you get a T1 time which depends on the magnetic field to the fifth power in the denominator. And up here is now, and this is why the strong confinement is important for the long lifetime, is the separation between the ground state and the excited state. And this is the phonon population here. And if you look at the experiment, it's somewhere between b to the minus 5 and b to the minus 4, what we observe here. And this is also what you expect. So the b to the minus 5, to explain this in a little detail, comes like this, that the matrix element goes with b to the squared times q squared, the wave vector, and I have as acoustic phonons, I have a linear dispersion here, q, and then from the matrix element I get 1 over tau b squared times q to the third power, and this is just proportional to the Zeeman energy, and that gives me a b to the cubed, and that gives us b to the 5. I think it's the dominant one is piezoelectric, I think, yeah. But both may contribute. But so the b to the 4 behavior one would get if one has certain finite temperature. If the temperature scale is larger than the Zeeman splitting, then you expand this and then you just get, let's say, something like the Zeeman energy in the denominator here, and we would get this kind of behavior in the temperature in the denominator here. So it should be proportional to temperature. So this is what the mechanism is. So at this high magnetic field, it looks at nuclear spins don't play a role, at least for the T1 time. They may play a role for the T2 time still, this fluctuating magnetic fields due to the nuclear polarization here. And in gallium arsenide, we have a lot of nuclear spins in such a system. So we try to test this finite temperature, so we increase the temperature, and what you see is that you get shorter times with increasing temperature, and if you now plot this, multiply this with temperature, then you see at least in the high magnetic field range they fall all on one curve here, and this is just the b to the minus 4 behavior, which we roughly see here. So this is, looks all consistent in a way that this is the only mechanism. At 30 Kelvin, at least here, we get some deviations, which maybe also, maybe due to two formal processes which come in around 30 Kelvin, but this is not really clarified what makes this deviation. But even at, I would say, if you look back at the absolute times, even at something like 30 Kelvin, we still have 100 nanoseconds or so as time at low temperature, which is quite normal, T1 time. Okay, we try also to test the dependence on the separation here. We couldn't do this quantitative because we did not know exactly the properties of this dot, but the general density tendency. When I have, let's say, the luminescence energy increased here, so I just look at dots with higher energy, that I have the tendency going from large dot size to small dot size, and this gives a larger splitting because of stronger confinement. And what you see at 8 Tesla and 1 Kelvin, you get a change in this time of the order of a factor of 10, something like below 50 microseconds here. Up to something like 300. So there seems to be a very strong dependence on this confinement energy and the splitting to the exact itself. Okay, this is so far for the spin storage. What are the open questions in this area? I mean, there is similar work in the electrostatic confinement around the same time by the Dale group and also in Japan, which also came up with T1 times of milliseconds. There is still, I think, an open question, why don't we get 100% spin polarization? Maybe other excitations play a role. Extrinsic effects, we think we could rule out, also not from the experiments, test experiments show that we should get 100% spin polarization if the light is polarized. So we have no problem experimentally.
So if you have heavy light mixing?
That's one question. If you have, now maybe it's some intrinsic effect, can we, at the ground state, the heavy load state has a mixture of light code mixing, which would give me this. The calculations of this ground state don't give so much light hole mixing that I would get only 60 to 80% polarization.
It should have to be very asymmetric in the plane, right? You probably have some idea of how asymmetric these dots are.
Asymmetry in the plane, sure. I mean, there are various things. Maybe there is a variation between roughly 60 and 80%. We measured many dots. None gave more than 80%, but we always found at least 60% polarization. So that's sort of the range what we see here. So this is one of the things which we don't completely understand in the system. The other one is what happens with the T1 times for a smaller magnetic field. At zero magnetic field, somehow the T1 time should come down again because of other interactions, especially with nuclear spins. It's very difficult to measure this experimentally. We just get up to 4 Tesla, down to 4 Tesla, just to speed to the minus 4 or speed to the minus 5 kilometers, and no turnover, at least at low temperature.
What's the experimental issue going to the lower?
Yeah, the problem is experimentally. Because it's the collection, it's a very simple problem. If you wait too long, more than a millisecond, let's say your accumulation time of light gets lower and lower. So most of the time you don't measure.
So it's very hard to measure the signals when you wait more than milliseconds, in a way. And if nothing happens after a millisecond, I cannot see the data. I mean, we measured at 3 Tesla, and we still had nice circular polarized light, and it's just horizontal. I cannot extract the time up to a millisecond. And we are in the process of measuring at smaller fields where we have this polarization problem, because then it's not anymore circular polarized, but more linear polarized. We have to understand the dot, and then we can look also in this area. Then thermality 2 times in these dots has not been measured. It has now in the electrostatically defined dots, but how it behaves in this stronger confinement. Things like these are experimental issues. There are theories which predict something in the magnetic field. Spin lifetimes of localized holes. We work on this already since quite some time and had a lot of problems. There are conflicting theories. There are theories which say it should be as long as electron spin lifetimes, and others which say it should be much shorter due to this confinement in orbit interaction when lifted. And we have first experimented a factor of 100 shorter than electrons, but that's preliminary. So it's we work on some holes here, which is maybe of interest. And then we work also on coherent control of the localized spins, combining it with microwaves, storing spins, and then do microwave flipping of the spins and read out with luminescence. Although we work since a year on this, no conclusive result yet, but this is very difficult to do. And then we're also working on single dot spin measurements by embedding the dots in micro cavities to get a much better collection efficiency also for this kind of experiments, just storage of this more experimental.
Does the anisotropic exchange make it difficult to measure the T2 times?
I think not at high magnetic fields. If I'm at low magnetic field or zero magnetic field, maybe. I think that would be cleaner when you can do single dot measurements, because in the moment we still average, I mean we measure one spin in each dot, but we average over 1,000 to 10,000 dots. And if each dot has a slightly different anisotropic exchange splitting, makes it probably very difficult. So we think we have to go to single dot measurements to be really have really clean experiments. And we know the dot, we can also measure the anisotropic exchange splitting. Maybe also tune it to zero in some dots. This is also possible that we have no anisotropic exchange splitting. But this requires then also for this, I think, single dots.
Would you tell us the number of dots which you are probing at the same time?
What?
What determines the number of dots which
the signal?
Signal strength.
The signal strength. I mean, in the moment, that's also, the signal strength is sort of a compromise. We don't use a million dots in this diode, it's how we focus the laser. We use in the moment between 1,000 and 10,000, but the signal gets weaker by the number of dots. And so, I think if we increase the collection efficiency with this photonic crystal microcavities, we may be able to do also these experiments for some dots to this future.
Just for those who don't know, like the anisotropic exchange is, this is an interaction effect, and if the dot was circularly symmetric, then it wouldn't produce a splitting? Is that the idea?
Could call it maybe three contributions.
Okay.
One is the shape anisotropy.
Mm-hmm.
Then even if you have it symmetric, the dot may be still strain anisotropy.
Okay.
It's a strain system. And then at least Alex Turner always claims that there is also an intrinsic effect by the crystal structure, which I think is very small, it's negligible.
Which wouldn't be there in a...
Which would be also there, that's just the inversion symmetry
of
the crystal structure. But I think this effect is relatively small. It is mainly the shape and maybe strain anisotropy.
Which strain? You mean shear strain tensor?
It's a complicated system. I mean, you have the helium gallium arsenide, it's a larger lattice constant, and now if you throw it on one load direction, very often you start with something like pyramids along certain crystal axes, but then at least in you smear this out, and also get segregation. So it's not a simple model of what the strain distribution really is. You can, in the realistic thoughts, which are overgrown, which also is that we don't know the helium, maybe we know that the helium segregates. So we even know that the ball on the top has more helium than at the bottom. This all plays a role in how the exact strain distribution looks like. And if it's still faceted, then you have various kinds of strain which contribute. So this is, the thing is, you can make nice models if you make a pyramid or a truncated pyramid, but the actual real structure may deviate from this because of segregation of the change in Indian concentration. You need, it's also included in models, but either every dot is different.
Okay. But the truncated pyramid, for example, gives you the splitting of the same order of magnitude as what you find.
I think most of the largest effect in the moment, I think, comes from the, in most of the dots, if you're looking for the shape by isotropy. This has to do with the rows. That you have a slightly different diffusion lengths in different orthogonal directions along on the 1-0 surface, mm-hmm. which makes the shape anisotropic.
And it is known whether the distribution of the strains follows the geometry of the organelle.
The distribution, I mean, if you can make, you can simulate this theoretically, which is done by many groups, but I am always saying if you overgrow such an island with gallium arsenide, you never have this what you have seen with on the surface. I mean, you can make very nice high resolution analysis on the surface. If you overgrow it, you get different conditions, and I think it's nearly impossible to simulate all this diffusion segregation.
How can you cleave it and look at it in cross section?
I have a few pictures from cleaved structures. So what you can do is, I'm also there to get an exact helium concentration across. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all backwards simulation. What you have. That's why I'm always, when I talk about the confinement potential, I just draw this schematic. And I also make barriers at the site because around the dot you have strain in the opposite direction, which opens the gap of gallium arsenide slightly. So you get the confinement, but then when you come from the gallium arsenide and then there's a wetting layer which has a different energy, you may have a barrier before you go into the dot. So this is basically this odd, but it's still something like.
Can I ask you? Can you make a lateral gate to if you have a single dot to shut off the anisotropic exchange?
I think it's better done by strain compensation or so. I mean, you can use the electric field to play with this also, to change. You can, the parameters are basically, we use electric fields to change the properties of the dot, and the other parameters is the strain, which you can apply also to the dot, which you can use for, and then there are also techniques which from the growth point of view in the leaving and things like this that you can get dots which have basically no anisotropic exchange with the system. I mean, this is also important in a way to overcome this when you want to use such dots for making things like entangled photons. So you have because if you have this anisotropic exchange splitting, you always have to overcome this problem with this depolarization that you get from splitting energy.
Michael, semantic question. What do you mean anisotropic exchange between different dots?
No, in one dot. So essentially you've got an exciton that's got an angular momentum 1, so that means that if you lower the symmetry, you can split it, and so you have an x and y state out of your x, y, z, you want to choose that as a basis. And so you don't have pure angular momentum states, it's your ground state.
So and your idea is to compensate this with an electric field if I have it in danger. Yeah, it's a certain electric field, maybe both. So, I still have 10 minutes or something like this, though. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then I want to talk a little about another project which we are working in, which in the beginning has not so much to do with spin, but it's very related to spin physics. Last week I talked mainly about this tunnel coupled balls. And there's always the question, especially the Pierre is asking this question often, is it really tunnel coupled or are there other coupling mechanisms, like dipole coupling, cluster coupling between these states? So what we do now is really singly dot, or in this case singly coupled dot experiment, which we have developed over many and several other groups over the past 8 years to look into real singly dots with a shadow mask. So we have again this Schottky diode, in this case now main diode. And we have here a shadow mask, so we don't look at many dots, but just select one pair in such an opening here, in the near field of this opening. And if we have underneath coupled dots, which we can grow stacked on top of each other, because if the separation is small enough, the strain gives us sort of a staggered or coupled dots on top of each other. Then you could again with the electric field maybe bring, let's say, the states in these dots in resonance, and we look at the coupling. And the question is this tunnel coupling? So, and then you can add, last week I tried to explain in detail, then we add extra charge. But extra charge can also come from trapping extra electrons in a new spectroscopy. For example, I excite one electron hole pair in the system. But during my measuring time, I have some CW laser, especially in the front region, I may create other electron pairs, and the hole would go out, but an electron may be trapped optically. So I can, statistically, I have also the possibility to have an extra electron in the system, which is then two electrons in one hole when I do the experiment. And electrostatically, we can bring in also a second electrons that I have finally two electrons plus an electron hole pair. I showed this last week that you can get a resonance with the electric field. So we tune, let's say, the electron hole pairs. This is an entanglement of such two dots, not the one we measured, because the sample was prepared for 10, but from a similar wafer, basically. And I always have the hole red and the electron blue here. Now I have, let's say, a nice tuning, because when I have them separated, I have a large dipole moment. And this large dipole moment, when I change the electric field, leads to a large shift in the exciton energy. While when they are on the same dot, I cannot separate the electron hole pair much. I have a very small dipole moment, and then I get a very weak shift. And that's why I can bring this in resonance. So this is an experimental trick to make a nice resonance. And according to the calculations, depending on the separation of these dots, we get the anticrossing. And if it's 10 nanometer separation, then this anticrossing is only of the order of a few millielectron volts, 2 to 3 or 4 millielectron volts. When we go down to 7 nanometer, it's already something like 15 millivolts, what this anticrossing is. So we work in a range where we have relatively small anticrossing, and then the situation is out here, we get just what we call the indirect exciton. Now the electron is, I have again, the situation here is the lowest in energy now.
So this is an anticrossing controlled by the Pannon integral.
In principle, yes, it's controlled by the separation and the barrier. But what I want to show was the electron. The hole doesn't play a role. It's the electron which tunnels between.
Because the hole is much heavier.
It's heavier, and from the situation, it's so that we have from the field the hole always in the upper part in the system because of the electric field how this diode is applied. Now to show this again, and so one of the experiments was like this, that you have this line coming, so this is the electric field, it's changed here, and then you get this indirect line here, and here is the direct line, and then you get this antigos. This is gaining intensity, then it's reduced in intensity, and this is going down here. But there are also other lines, and I marked this and explained this last time, that this is negatively charged. I add one extra electron, and this is from the singlet, and this is from the triplet situation in this system. Now we understand all this quite well. This is this adding, and this is just plotting this data slightly different. So this is this anti-crossing which we observe here. This is the singlet and triplet, which makes them, the triplet makes an anti-crossing at smaller fields. So this is what we see. So just to show you the total spectrum again, this is this anti-crossing I'm talking about now. And down here we have the singlet, which is in the way the indirect singlet, that the electron is in the other dot, and then it's shifting over here in energy when I have it in the same dot, at smaller fields. But this is all quite well understood. But this lines, and also that in the singlet case we had basically more lines, and then see this in this projection here. There is a weak line here and a weak line here. And this is the triplet of the negative charge. So, where you see here, this is a triplet situation where we have the same spin. So, the spin plays a very important role in what you really see. If you have singlet situation, you get completely different lines than in the triplet situation. I had last week in my talk and explain it in detail how we understand all these different, these many different lines which we see when you change the electric field. Now one of the questions was if this is really tunnel coupling, and one of the things what we ever did is things like time results spectroscopy, but you can see also one peculiar thing already, and this is if you look at the coupling. So the minimum energy, the coupling energy, you have a certain electric field. But at this field, you don't have the same intensity of the two lines. So the crossing of the intensity, that's intensity divided by the sum of the intensities here, is at higher fields. And this indicates already that you have some loss from the upper branch, because the upper branch has, decays down to the lower branch. Now when you do, this is a situation, so this is for the bonding state, so this is where we have the resonance, and this is for the anti-bonding state here, and you get a much higher intensity for this state, exactly at resonance. Now, one of the things is that this indicates that we have at the critical field, which is around 16 kilovolts per centimeter, and I use here now the difference of this as a delta of F, I get relaxation from the upper branch to the lower branch. And if you do time result spectroscopy at a certain field, what you see is for the two branches, two different time scales. This is at higher field now. And if you plot, the time or the rate, and this is schematic, these two branches here. What you see is, on this side I have the indirect, so the rate is very small, so it's relatively long time. It's indirect, so the matrix element should be small. And this is direct, so the rate is high, so you get a short time. in this area it's rather difficult to measure, because what you see here in the spectrum is that there are these other lines, this triplet line, this singlet line here, so the intensity here is rather difficult to follow, and also the time is obscured by these extra lines here. So we concentrate here on, let's say, this speed range here to this side, so we have this anti-Rossi. So this is what you expect that you get, let's say, this should be long time here, and this should be short time, or the ring like it is. Now, however, if you also take the intensity into account, and if you look at the relaxation, what we have is something like, we have the upper branch, which I call is the rate RA, the lower branch is RB, and then you may have relaxation down here, and reabsorption or excitation up, and there may be also a channel which is capturing during the time an extra electron. So this negatively charged exciton is also a channel, because I mean during this lifetime the laser is on, so I can create more electron voltage, and there's a probability to capture an extra electron. So we need some things like rate equations for this. So we have the radiation determination rate for these branches here, then the relaxation rate from the upper to the lower branch, and an electron capture rate we included in these rate equations, and also activation rate. And if you look now, let's say, so we believe at low temperatures from the energy separation, we estimate that the activation rate is much smaller than the relaxation down. And so when we fit now the intensities, we get basically this rate. So for A, we have the radiative accumulation rate plus some probability to capture an extra electron plus the relaxation down. And in the other case, only radiative accumulation rate, also plus many extra electrons which you capture. Now when you look at this, so this would give down here this rate, and up here we should have this rate for this upper branch. And so when we look at the crossing, I would say that this relaxation here, you can estimate directly if this is the contribution, that the critical field is of the order of a nanosecond. So it's of the same order as the radiative time. So if I go to this lower branch, then this is what we measure experimentally for the rate with this rate equation. And if I compare this with the symptoms, the calculation, where we used, let's say, the program developed at the Fock Institute for calculating the wave functions, and just compare this, used here, M nanometers and this 15.3 million electron volts, you get very nicely, a very good agreement for this, for the lower branch. But if you do this for the upper branch, what you see is the upper branch lives much shorter. And this difference is mainly this T, but maybe also a little that we capture a negative charge, an extra negative charge. But this is the splitting, but this is the minimum splitting, but this is the resonance here, zero field. And we have this difference, and we believe this is due to the relaxation, which is of the order 1 nanosecond. And if one compares this with calculations from the literature theory, which take into account, again, like in the spin relaxation before here, phonon-mediated transitions, such as the phonons, they come up with very similar time scales. So it looks that we get on a nanosecond time scale relaxation from the upper branch. So this is what the experimental analysis gives us. So it's very nice again what I have here, the intensity at low temperature. And then you can show that this really is the right interpretation. We increase the temperature, then we should increase this activation process. And if you do this, you get very nicely at 45 Kelvin. You shift this intensity crossing closer to the field, to the resonance field, because then these two rates get more and more similar. And this you see also, if you just plot now, let's say, the intensity ratio at a certain field, like here, where you have a low temperature, this large difference with increasing temperature, they merge. And on the other side, if you go here, you have the crossing with increasing temperature, they go apart. So this gives us a good feeling that this interpretation is right, that we have on a nanosecond time scale here relaxation down from the upper branch due to acoustic hormone. And I want to, I showed this, unfortunately, this projection, this weak lines are hardly visible here. But you see, I showed now this antiglossing here, this behavior. And so we have here a relaxation down by acoustic hormones of the order of 3 millivolts, roughly splitting. If you would have larger splitting, you may run into the problem of some kind of hormone body and that you cannot get this relaxation on such cost on the nanosecond time scale. I just want to emphasize, if you go to this line, this is a triplet that I have an extra electron with the same spin in the system. And this is the anti-glossing for this. If you do the same analysis here, you get the same intensity exactly at the crossing. So there this relaxation does not play a role. So this would involve, when I go down here, basically that I cannot relax down because in the triplet configuration I have the two spins that's the same. And this relaxation, so the crossing intensity, and this is all the same. In the moment we are just working time result spectroscopy in this lines to see also the anti-crossing in this coupled regime. I think this is a very interesting situation where we have this extra electron, where we can go from the singlet to the triplet situation and manipulate very nicely in such coupled dots the systems. We understand this now since about half a year as a basic spectra, and in the moment we are just trying to do, let's say, more detailed studies on this, including magnetic field for the doubly charged oxytone, which is down here, the triplet and the singlet situation, and the single charge exciton triplet and singlet here, and to manipulate the states also in the time scale and do some coherent manipulation of this.
And there is no anti-crossings between singlet and triplet. They cross perfectly. Or you see some features?
Problem is, I suppose, the singlet and triplet, if I have an extra electron, I cannot really follow it. So triplet is this line and this line. And this is the anti-crossing I can have an anti-crossing, but not in the final state. The singlet is this line plus this weak line, which in this projection one doesn't see here, plus this crossing here. Which is, this is direct transition here, and I do not see really a crossing of the triplet with the singlet. I don't come into this region.
But this strong crossing just in the center.
This, yeah.
What it is, yes.
This is two different situations you could call it in time. This is a single exciton. And this is a negatively charged exciton, which I have, let's say, statistically sometimes by trapping another electron. And that's why these are not correlated at all. This is a different configuration in the dot. So this is not, I could not expect here anything because it's...
Of course, charged configuration.
Right, but it's a situation where I have an extra electron in the singlet and triplet state. The main lines are these two for the triplet and this for the singlet. And this is a singlet moving one electron from the dot where the hole is to the other dot. Now, in principle, this allows now, this is the same thing what we can do now, very similar things what Gianni Marco's group, for example, or the Delft group did with transport in coupled thoughts, electrostatic coupled. We can do all this in optics now, with advantages and disadvantages. The advantage, we have also, let's say, the excited states which we can control. We have very nice region where in the electric field can control this coupling between the dots. And I think in the optics on such a system, we will see on this such coupled system which you can really tune, we will see a lot of interesting results also for coherent excitations in the near future. I think we have it now under control that we really can manipulate at least two such dots very, very nicely in such a system. Okay, I think this was the second part, and I will not talk about spins in silicon and germanium based systems. It would take another 1 or 2 hours. I want to end with part of the group, which was a year ago. We have every beginning of March an internal, we call it winter school, a weekend in the Austrian Alps. This is a very old farmhouse from 1675, I think, where we stay, and also PhD students with nice walks, and it was often skiing, basically from Friday until Monday. And
it's your group advertisement.
Group advertisement. And Jonathan Finley is since 2.5 or 3 years now really in my group responsible for all this prospecting on the talks. And he was not in this meeting, it was a year ago. This year he joined us, but this is the old picture, because I said already that was the time when they his wife kind of thing got paid. Okay, got the basics. So let me thank you for your attention.
Questions? More questions?
I mean, you were saying at the very end that you're going to the direction where you also want to, you know, use now the coupling to see this effect similar to the lateral dots. Are there any ideas how you would control the coupling?
This is a disadvantage. What I cannot do in a fixed sample is control this energy. Or let's say we're seeing exit on this coupling energy. This is given by how I prepare the sample, the separation of the balls. I can change this from sample to sample, but I have no knob to change this. But what I can do is I can miss the electric field, basically tune it in resonance, that I couple the single electron hole pair or I couple the triplet situation in the system. And as a control, I have the optical spectroscopy. So I can come in with, for example, a two-color laser that I excite in resonance into a certain branch and then block another branch and can do coherent control basically in this way. So this is it's not possible with the system as it is now that I, in one sample, let's say, change this anti-process, which would be changing the coupling strengths between the balls. I have to go from sample to sample and look at the process. But this is not possible.
So what kind of physics are you interested in, the Mn and manganese-based silicon germanium structures?
There was this paper some years ago that they found with a claim that they have a TC of 110 Kelvin for manganese and germanium. And we should just try to repeat it, getting a semiconductor, a silicon germanium based semiconductor.
What's manganese germanium? Isoelectronic, acceptor, donor, something else?
Manganese is more like a deep acceptor in germanium. Now I just show you some of our results on this germanium manganese. This is the growth temperature. And what you see is you get very nice magnetization curve, but also what last week discussed, that this doesn't say you have a dilute magnetic semiconductor. And what you really have is something like this. You have here, I just took one, now it's 85. You have here something like super paramagnetism, which is here a blocking machine. And down here, we believe we have a spinning house, which other people believe it's ferromagnetic, so it's low temperature, but I don't believe this. And if you do a deep dive, just quickly, if you do a deep dive, it is a materials-oriented project in the moment. Can we make a ferromagnetic semiconductor in the silicon germanium system? We have, you asked for the doping, we have in this sample, which is coherent, don't see this quite well, it has a manganese-rich cluster, but it has the lattice structure of germanium. And in this sample, we have p-type doping, but not as much as we expected. So I don't know, we have not many holes in the system. Nevertheless, I think this is, which gives rise to the, what I call, let's say, the spin glass. If you go to higher temperatures, you always get this precipitate, which cloud with manganese 5, germanium 3, which has this ferromagnetic behavior. But if you have them diluted, then you get this behavior that you have here. You also have a blocking temperature and then the super paramagnetism of this cluster. And then this is the blocking regime.
And what does it mean, blocking regime?
Blocking regime means that that if the temperature is low enough that the magnetic moments of these clusters, individual clusters, are locked. And this happens at a certain lower temperature. It's not, let's say, it's not, you have this precipitate as individual crystallized embedded, which have also another different crystal structure in such system. While, so you need very low temperature to get this, but also here we don't get really ferromagnetism up to what was claimed in this power paper 3 years ago, 110 Kelvin. There are other papers which claim that at this, let's say, at this region, that this is ferromagnetic. I don't believe that this is ferromagnetic. We have a lot of detailed measurements of this. So the goal is, can we get gallium manganese arsenide in the silicon germanium system in a way, but it's a materials-oriented project.
This germanium manganese compound,
3-5,
is a ferromagnetic.
That's
yeah, that's one.
Right, that's this ferromagnetic, up at room temperature. That's what this curve basically gives you. If you grow it at high enough temperature, you get a lot of the small ferromagnets. Then the magnetization looks more like manganese 5, manganese 7 to manganese 5. And you should know that it's a temperature of 300 Kelvin.
Is your system good for studying an optical RKKY interaction?
I don't think so. Or why? Maybe, I don't know really, but it's... you mean this system? Or this
no, I meant the quantum dots.
The quantum dots?
Yeah, where you have two quantum dots, one on top of each other.
Yeah, you think about when you change the separation between the dots, would be one possibility.
Well, there's this
time. And then you look at putting two electrons.
He wants to establish the interaction between them optically. He's in this coherent thing that you showed the case.
Yeah, I think that's possible. That we can really use the carbon dots and not just our system for doing this kind of thing.
Especially since you understand
yeah.
systems quite well.
Right. I think that should be possible, yeah. Now, I mean, it took so much work to understand all these lines.
Right.
You now have to think what can you do with all this.
That's your starting point, right?
That's the starting point now, right?
But could you elaborate what you mean? I didn't quite understand the question.
Well, so it's the idea of, in my way of understanding things, if you have a semiconductor, let's say, or a quantum dot, and you shine on a laser which has below the gap, so there's no absorption, then basically it changes the bands, right? It makes the states into some time-dependent coherent combination of the ground state and the exciton state, let's say. And because of that change, it makes the system polarizable. So if there's some exchange coupling between the two dots, you can control its strength.
So it's a non-linear optical effect. You know,
yes.
And then you have to come in with the intense laser below the this level here, and with this change the this whole coupling structure.
And what should be measured?
You can change the time average relative spin polarization in two couple dots. I'm not sure that's the best thing to measure.
I wonder whether you could get an effective signature.
Well, that's exactly it.
Can you do spectroscopy? Like here with the two electrons.
Yes.
Electronic hole.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure you can get up so you could see spectroscopy.
I mean, here you have to see the difference looking because of the position of the two dots and the initial and final state.
Mm-hmm. Is this sigma the triplet between two electrons or one electron and one hole?
When I talk about singlet triplet, it's always with respect to the electrons. I have two electrons in the system, and when I have the singlet situation, I get a coupling from the initial state configuration, which are two electrons like this plus one hole. And I get the coupling in the final configuration between the two dots, so I have the two electrons with opposite spin electrons. That's why I get four lines. These are this line, this weak line, this one, and one up here somewhere. If you want to see it, and it can look very nice here, but this is this projection. And if you have a triplet situation, this is the difference from the electrostatic to my dots, so it could be just two electrons, you have seen that they're different. Here I have the initial state, which adds to these two electrons at home. And then I have now the same electrons, the same speed in the system. Then I have, in the different situation, I can have a splitting only in the initial state and not in the final state. Because the two electrons, the electron cannot move over to the other dot. So this is what gives me. This is the splitting in the initial state of the triplet, not in the final state.
Yeah, I think that basically the prediction is that this picture would change.
This would change, right?
If you...
But it would also change probably already down here, for the single electron hole there, and especially if you had an expression.
Well, and you hope it will be changing in a controllable way.
Yeah, that's
in a tunable way.
That was the proposal. That you can make the coupling, single triplet splitting, much bigger while the light is on and when it's not on.
But if I remember, this proposal was for a single dot, not for a coupled dot.
Two isolated dots, which are then coupled.
Two separate.
And so there has to be some
coupled through
in between the wave functions and the two
dots.
Generated by
the
self-resonant field.
So here you would need two separate dots, which you then couple via this virtual interaction.
Yeah, but what I mean is, what in principle you would do is you would optically maybe shift this coupling field, which I didn't get stuck in sleep by a couple.
That certainly would happen, yeah, because you'll change the energies in the
eventual states. You'll change the
eventual states. Okay. Okay, any questions? All right, just thank your speaker again.